I want to welcome back to the A Minute to Midnight show, John Haller. Had John on the show a couple of times before. It's always been very interesting. It's been a wee while, so it's great to have you back again today, John.
Good to be back again with you, Tony.
And there's a lot of different directions to go with today's discussion. A lot of interesting things are happening and how it all fits in with Bible prophecy, which you do a lot of research on. So where would you like to start us, John?
Well, you know, it's funny you mentioned that because I sent you a brief outline or just a few topics. And then as I was just sort of looking through things today, I do follow the news and geopolitics and intelligence reports and defense reports and assessments and that type of thing pretty closely. And the reason I do that, Tony, is I do a thing called Prophecy Update, as you know, each week. And I know that the prophetic scriptures, when they unfold, when these things actually begin to come to pass, are going to take place in a real world. And there are many indications that we see that indicate that this could very well be the time. It becomes increasingly clear every day. And I've sort of jokingly said that when I do my update at Fellowship Bible Chapel each week, some Sunday, I'm just going to go up there without any preparation and just look at my, you know, the various news feeds that I get, and I'll just talk about things. I heard, I think it was Bill Salas, who's a friend of mine, was talking the other day, and he said that, you know, I used to, and we actually played golf when I was in California last month, and we talked about this, and we talk about this every time we get together. It used to be that every week or 10 days, you might find a headline or a story or something happening in the world that would seem to fit within the patterns that Bible prophecy talks about. Now we're to the point where it seems like it's every hour, if not a number of times an hour, something significant happens. Everything is very volatile. I talk about and have for years talked about the convergence of events, likening it to like everything sort of converging on a point. And I think that point is the second coming of Christ. And so that will sort of be the where everything converges together. But as they get closer and closer, it's almost like a vortex that you would have in a tornado. And things get very turbulent. And it certainly seems like we seem to go from one thing to the next now in the world. And everything is very turbulent, and everything is happening very quickly. One of the topics I suggested to you, and something that I think is sometimes overlooked in geopolitics and Bible prophecy, is demographics. We live in a world of enormous demographic change. And we know that there are certain players in the end times that are going to be very significant. We have Israel. We have Iran or Persia, I think Russia, Egypt, Turkey, and Saudi Arabia. I think all of these, they're all mentioned in Ezekiel 38 and 39 and elsewhere. And even Syria and Damascus is mentioned in Jeremiah 49, Zechariah 9, and Isaiah 17. So I think all of these places that are mentioned will have significant events occurring with them. And it seems like every day you look, things are happening very quickly. I don't remember what I talk a lot. I do at least an hour and a half or so prophecy update each week. I do a number of radio interviews from time to time, such as this. So I don't always know if I'm repeating myself. But in 2011, we were in Israel on a tour. The second day, two nights we stayed at a resort at the southern end of the Sea of Galilee. Beautiful, beautiful place. You can see clear across the lake from there. And the second morning we were there, I got up and checked the news. There had been a suicide bombing or attack at the bus station in Jerusalem the day before, and a British tourist had been killed. It was kind of significant. It was during the first or just they were just getting ready to launch the first Jerusalem Marathon. So it was, everybody's a little disconcerted about it because of where it occurred at the central bus station. But 30 miles to the east of us in a town called Dara, they were starting to have riots. They were having protests. And that eventually cascaded into the Syrian civil war, which 7 years later is still with us. This was March of 2011. Mm. And it was kind of an interesting contrast because there we were in Israel. And aside from the terrorist bombing that took place in Jerusalem, it's very strange because it's of course surrounded by countries that would really rather that it not exist. But there's a strange sense of security when you're there. And so here we are, you know, this peaceful setting and a resort at the southern end of the Sea of Galilee, and 30 miles away is starting a civil war, the riots that will eventually lead to a civil war, which has effectively destroyed Syria as a country. But there's not much left. There's probably somewhere between 500,000 and a million. I think it's probably closer to a million people dead. At the start of that war, Syria had 21.5 million people. The last estimate I've seen is that 10.5 million people are displaced, meaning they don't live where they lived 7 years ago. If you put that in terms of the United States, that would mean a similar proportion would be about 165 million people don't live where they lived during the Obama, you know, at the just before Obama was reelected. It's shocking what's happened and how quickly it's happened. And part of that, but part of the thing that plays into that is demographics. And we don't really think about that, but a lot of these countries that, at least according to scripture, are significant players in the end times have a tremendous demographic problem. I can talk about that on a number of levels. Let me talk first about Israel. We spent a couple weeks in Israel last spring, last May, we were there during the Trump visit in May. We were also there when they celebrated on the Jewish calendar the 50th anniversary of the Six-Day War in 1967. And we were in Jerusalem, actually, on a day when they said that there were more people in Jerusalem on that day than had ever been in Jerusalem in any day in its history. And it was tremendous. I mean, there was a great time of celebration. Part of our trip, we spent touring areas that most tourists never go to see. They're in Judea, biblical Judea and Samaria, the biblical heartland, commonly called the West Bank. What was interesting about that, you know, there's always this issue about, well, Israel could never have a one-state solution because if they have a one-state solution, the Palestinians would have way too many people and they would take over, they would control the democratic institutions, and Israel would lose its character as the world's only Jewish state. There are a lot of people that disagree with that. There's some good work that's come out from a former ambassador named Yoram Edinger. And then Caroline Glick, one of my favorite authors, columnist, writers, wrote a book a couple years ago called The Israeli Solution, where she tore apart the demographic studies that have been done. And it was interesting when we were there, having read these books and reading Ambassador Edinger's work, as we're traveling through the West Bank, the one thing that I noticed was that we would go to these places that were very well built up, near the biblical cities of Bethel and Ai, particularly Ai. It's really in a neighborhood that rivals, you know, the best neighborhoods in America in terms of the size, quality, of the houses. They're mansions. But the interesting thing is, as we went to a number of these sites and we went to these places that are Palestinian villages, there was nobody there. I mean, we saw nobody all day long. Now, of course, when you're in Bethlehem, when you're in Ramallah, and a couple in Nablus, you'll see people. But in some of these neighborhoods, they don't stay there. They've left. And so I discount a lot of these claims that the Palestinians far outnumber Israel.
Well, while you're on that point, I just want to bring up something that I had somebody commenting on one of my Minutes Midnight previous videos about Israel and that whole area and saying all the Christians have left Bethlehem and those places because of persecution from the Jews. And my argument was, well, hang on a second, you're missing the elephant in the room. It's because of the Palestinian Muslims that the Christians, you know, have gone from those areas largely. What are your thoughts on it?
Well, I would agree with your assessment. You know, we're in a couple weeks, well, I guess in a month, they're going to have the fifth or sixth Christ at the Checkpoint Conference in Bethlehem. And one of the things there, those are Palestinian Christians, they're going to come and they're going to say that it's the Jews' fault. It's often that's sort of the mem that gets passed around quite a bit. It's, well, we're persecuted because of the Jews. But I can tell you, Tony, that within the Palestinian areas and sitting and talking to some people that I did, Arab people, some of whom were Hamas supporters as opposed to the PLO, in the area of the West Bank, there's tremendous persecution of Palestinian versus Palestinian. It's a very tribal society. There are many of them that don't like Mahmoud Abbas, Abu Mazen, because he's in the 12th year of a 4-year term. And they don't like him because he's from up around Nazareth. And so that's a different tribe than is the tribe that is really from down around Ramallah. And as a result, it's a very fractured society anyway. But look, I have plenty of friends who are Christians. And look, there are restrictions and some persecution that takes place of Christians. I've supported in the past a ministry for helping Jewish believers because they are persecuted. And the Orthodox Jews can be awful, but the Palestinian people, by and large, I'm just telling you, you go throughout the West Bank in these places that have these large homes and communities, at least during the day, are virtually empty. We didn't see anybody. We had one guy come over and talk to our guide because they knew each other in Bethel. We didn't see anybody at Ai. We didn't see anybody at Shiloh. And when we were in Nablus, we didn't see that many people either, even on the street. Now, it was Friday morning, so they were at mosque, the prayers at the Friday prayers at the local mosque. But the Christians aren't fleeing from the Palestinian areas because of the Jews. They're fleeing because of the Palestinian Muslims' persecution. They're fleeing in large part from areas in Syria and Iraq and Kurdistan and the Kurdish areas of Iraq, Iran, and Syria because of persecution of Muslims. I'm very troubled by the inability of the world to deal with or discuss the Islamic problem right in our midst. It has particular relevance in the United States right now. The president's being investigated by Robert Mueller. Robert Mueller was the head of the FBI. He became the head of the FBI during the Bush 43 administration, about a week after 9/11. And so under the Bush administration, and then I think more so under the Obama administration, there was, I believe, a pretty good infiltration of a lot of our security and other apparatus like this of people associated with the Muslim Brotherhood and other Muslim groups, with the result that the FBI under Mueller, there was – FBI agents were at risk if they actually talked about the Islamic problem in real terms. A friend of mine, Phil Haney, worked at the Department of Homeland Security from its inception, and he was putting together information in the various databases about the terror networks, the Islamic terror networks that operated worldwide and in the United States. And there were people that didn't like him, and their agenda was to squelch that problem. And he was brought up on internal charges and investigated 8 times before he finally retired. By the way, he has a book out called See Something, Say Nothing. And he had put together information that probably would have, I think, stopped the San Bernardino shooting that occurred about 2 years ago. And I think it was in November, December of 2015. I happened to fly into California the day after that happened. And then you could see that there's quite a police presence out there in that area where my wife's stepfather lives. So I think it's the same problem that's happening with regard to what we say about Israel, because people are just saying that, well, they're leaving because it's the Jews. But I I've been there a number of times. I've never seen that. I've never worried about it. Sure, some of the Orthodox groups are very difficult in terms of that. And it's not easy being a Jewish believer in Israel. There's no doubt. I mean, people lose their jobs and that type of thing. But, you know, the people leaving the Palestinians are leaving the Palestinian areas, I guess is my point. And the only way they get the population numbers high is to double count them. And we know that Islamic immigration is a huge problem. My view, and I probably have a little different view than some of the people who say that the whole Syrian civil war is the sole result of interference and various people in the world that are trying to start a world war. I don't doubt that there are people that are trying to do that. But there were a lot of somewhat demographic problems that led to the outbreak of the Syrian civil war. They had just gone through a very severe drought for about 3 years. That created a lot of economic pressure. And the Assad regime comes from the Alawites, which is a more secularized version of Shia Islam. For example, I believe a lot of the Alawites will drink alcohol, which Shia Islam would not do. But the heartland of Syria, the breadbasket, which would include the areas that we've just been hearing about, Duma and Eastern Ghouta, Duma being where that chemical attack did or did not happen a few weeks back. That's still, you know, to be honest with you, I've studied it. I've read a lot about it. I don't know whether it happened or not. We can probably talk. I know you had Doug Woodward and Gary Hoffman on to talk a little bit about that. And I don't know whether it happened. And I'm not necessarily, I don't think it's a good thing for us to be involved there, frankly, as an American. I don't know that the response that we did throwing, you know, $500 million or so worth of missiles in there accomplish much of anything. Certainly hasn't changed what Putin has done or what Assad has done. But that area there, which was the breadbasket of Syria, is a Sunni Islamic area. And when the Sunnis revolted against their view of very oppressive dictatorship of the Assad family, they form rebel groups. And a lot of these rebel groups align with very bad terrorists. Some of them morphed into this group called ISIS. And a lot of this happened because, frankly, we went into Iraq and we broke it. And the only way that a Saddam Hussein was able to keep his society together was to be a brutal dictator, because they're not only tribal, but they're also very divided by their different stripes of Islam. Example of that would be, Tony, up in northern Syria. You've seen Turkey has moved into northern Syria. and attacked and taken over a town called Afrin in northwest Syria. Now, Turkey is Sunni Muslim. Erdogan, the leader of Turkey, is Sunni. He is very closely allied, I believe, with the Muslim Brotherhood. I know he's been, when things started to unfold in Egypt a number of years back, he was one of the first people to go down there and say, oh, look at this great revolution. And what they did in Egypt when the Muslim Brotherhood took over was they essentially did a truncated, accelerated version of what it took Erdogan pretty much a dozen years to accomplish in Turkey, the way he took it over and became this effectively the supreme leader there. But when they went into northern Syria to Afrin, they were going against Kurdish forces that were largely Sunni Muslim also. But there is a view in the Sunni community that the Kurdish Muslims are descendants from jinns or genies, and therefore they're sort of like the Nephilim, like we would talk about the Nephilim. They're interbreeding with this dark spirituality, and they're subhuman, and therefore it's okay to attack and kill them. So even within there's a demographic issue, but that's a very good example of where the demographic issue is coming to a head. Turkey has a demographic problem. Its birth rate is falling. Iran has a problem. Its birth rate is falling. The one place where they're growing and producing more children, their demographics are improving, is in the Kurdish areas of Syria, Iran, and Iraq. And that it's going to have, and so I'm not sure how all that plays into Bible prophecy if the Lord's coming is delayed a while.
Just for clarification, what do the Kurds actually believe? What branch of Islam are they? And also the second question is, I have seen some articles and people claiming that Bashar al-Assad actually protects the Christians in Syria. So I'm just wondering on your thoughts on that.
Well, I do think that if we go back in time to 2011, if you go back in time to the 1950s, when I was just a little tyke, I do remember this thing that existed for a decade or so called the United Arab Republic. And that was an alliance, a republic between Syria and Egypt. It was headed up by Nasser, who was the head of Egypt, who really wanted to get rid of Israel. They had a war in 56. After that, they formed this United Arab Republic. And what happened in Syria, I was just watching a fascinating video on Al Jazeera about this the other day that sort of refreshed my memory about the history of that. In Syria, to keep that together, the secret police really came to the fore. Eventually, in the late 60s, a young guy in the secret police service came and took over, and his name was Assad, Bashar al-Assad, Hafez al-Assad. And he took over about 1970, and he ruled till he died around 2000. He was in power for about 30 years. And he was brutal, but he was also very good, as I think his son was, at sort of keeping all of these factions, everything tamped down. What happened, though, was, as I mentioned, there was in the late 2008 to 2011, there was a very severe drought in Syria that had huge economic ramifications in that breadbasket Sunni heartland, and they started rebelling against what they thought was heavily taxing them regime. It is true, I believe, that the lot of Christians was much better under the Assad regime than it would be under an ISIS or some of these Sunni rebel groups, these Islamic-related, Al-Qaeda-related, al-Nusra Front, and all these, certainly that's very bad for Christians. I don't think there was much interest on the part of the United States at that time, and certainly I don't think even today Israel, I think, viewed Assad as someone that they could manage, that they could live with.
Right.
They took back the Golan Heights in 1967, and for 50 years now, when we were there in May, we drove up into the Golan along the no man's land there between Syria and Israel. And then all along the Lebanon border, all the way over to the Mediterranean, there's some roads that go. And, you know, so we're right up there in the Hezbollah area of Lebanon and all that. And Israel, there's some people have the view that Israel wants to take over, you know, the whole Middle East.
Yeah. We had a bit of a dropout here with John, internet issue, so we're picking up again. So sorry for the bit of discontinuity perhaps here, folks, but John, let's pick up as best as you can where you left off.
Sure. It's still pretty amazing, though, that we can talk. I mean, you're literally halfway around the world,
yeah.
And it sounds like you're sitting right next to me. So we were talking about Syria and the issue of the Assad regime. I don't think it was necessarily in the United States' interest to do anything to mess with that. He was, in some respects, a fairly brutal dictator, especially against the people that were not his tribe. The meme that gets passed around a lot, Tony, is that, especially with the chemical attack, is, well, Assad would never do that to his people. Why would he gas his own people? And the reason that is a flawed argument is because he doesn't consider them to be his people. They're Syrians and they're people that pay taxes, but they're not part of his group. They're not Alawite. They're not related to his family. And so the Alawites are a minority in Syria, but they've been able to control the levers of power now for almost 50 years through the current Assad and his father. So whether he would do that to deal with his problem, let me just sort of truncate this because I think I'm getting lost in the weeds a bit. What happened was that as the rebel groups came together, funded in part, I think, by the United States and other Western governments, sort of rise up against the opportunism of the Iranians who were moving into the area. They allied with these groups, and they're bad groups. There's no doubt about that. I mean, we saw what ISIS did, and some of the groups that have been supported in Syria and the Sunni areas are, frankly, they're just as bad as ISIS. But Assad, what he saw was an opportunity to essentially get rid of his Sunni problem. He had a Sunni demographic problem. They're very much larger in population numbers than the Alawites. And so he saw an opportunity. And then when Russia came in about 3 years ago, they essentially... I just don't think there's any question that this happened. Now, I know this will be very controversial in some quarters, but it is clear from looking at the picture of city after city and village after village in the Sunni areas of Syria that Assad, with the assistance of Russia and Iran, has essentially got they barrel bomb those areas. There's just no doubt. Look at the damage of those buildings. Look at the drone footage of Aleppo, of Damascus, of the Sunni areas of Damascus. Other areas of Damascus are virtually untouched. Somebody that had an air force was able to barrel bomb and bomb those areas and get the Sunnis to leave. There's a rather there's a pretty good interview. It would have been in late 2015, I believe, maybe 2014, General Breedlove, who was the Supreme Commander of NATO in Europe at the time, testifying before one of the congressional committees in our Congress, talking about the fact that they barrel bombed the areas and they got the people up and moved on the road. Those people have now moved into Europe. That is, in by all estimates, the initial wave of immigrants into Europe have been about 85% military-aged males. This has had a bit of a destabilizing result on Europe. There are many countries, you know, we know the stories about no-go zones in Sweden and France and elsewhere. Macron, in a speech just last week, was talking about the demographic, making allusions to the demographic issues that are facing Europe and how Europe is going to have to become more inclusive. Now, Russia has a demographic problem. Europe has a demographic problem. Their populations are in decline. Places like Spain have a birth rate of 1.1 births per female. You need 2.1 just to stay even. They're at 1.1. Russia is about 1.2. I think Italy is 1.2 or 1.3. The result of that means that in one generation, there's half as many people as there were in the prior generation. In Moscow, the reports that I have read indicate that Moscow is now 25% Sunni Muslim. I think that's one of the reasons why Putin sees in the immediate term that he has a Muslim problem. And he's gone into Syria to try to deal with that. And by getting the Sunnis out of that area, they're moving into Europe and destabilizing Europe, which is sort of an added benefit for somebody like Putin. There was a book that just came out, and I think this was referenced in Macron's speech last week, that it's a book by Stephen Smith. He's a professor at Duke University in North Carolina here in the United States, and it's called The Rush to Europe. And he's looking, too, at the demographic problem that Europe faces. I had some stats that I pulled out of his talk. I mentioned to you when we were talking ahead of time that back in 1956, a town that he lived in Africa, he speaks fluent French, had about 300,000 people in it. That town now has 2.5 million. By 2050, Europe will have 450 million people. I believe that's somewhere in the neighborhood of what they have right now. They won't grow, but their birth rates are declining, which means that that population will be replacement people from somewhere else. Africa is projected by 2050 to have a population of 2.5 billion. Africa is growing. The interesting thing is that since 1930, Africa's population has increased. I believe in 1930, their population was 150 million in Africa. Now, I could be wrong on that, but I think I pulled that out of an interview that Dr. Smith did. And 40% of them now are under the age of 15. That means they're going to continue to grow, and they're going to look elsewhere for opportunity because of the poverty in Africa, and they're going to go to Europe, and they're going to change the face of Europe. So the reason why I think this is kind of a long way of saying that this plays into Bible prophecy is the fact that for Persia, for Turkey, and some of these countries that we're told will come against Israel in the last days, I think that happens in the near term, because I think the leaders of those countries know that they're going to have to do something before their population shift occurs. I think they're smart enough to know that. And I just think, I mean, you can go and you can read studies at The Economist and that type of thing. Worldwide, the demographics don't work. In the United States, we have made promises to public municipal employees as to what we're going to do in terms of pensions. We have promises made to people for Social Security. When the Social Security program started in the 1930s, there were somewhere around 40 to 50 workers would pay taxes to support one person on Social Security. We are now at the place where it's about 2.5 workers have to pay taxes to support one person. Now, somebody who's getting close to Social Security, I want that to continue because I've paid a lot of money in my life into Social Security. And I figure I deserve to get my, it's not really an investment, it's really a Ponzi scheme. But this is happening in our public pensions. By a lot of estimates, while the United States may have a federal debt of $20 trillion, there's a professor at one of the Boston universities or colleges, I think his name is Lawrence Kotlikoff, and he's done some studies, and he estimates that the unfunded pension public liabilities in the United States between our states and our federal government total somewhere around $200 trillion.
Wow.
In California, I believe that shortfall is about $1.4 trillion. It's shocking. I mean, the Los Angeles Times a few years back did a study of what it costs, what you would have to invest at the current investment returns that they were getting to pay the pension of the average state employee. And do you know what the number was? It was $2 million.
Wow.
You would have to invest. That's for the average.
Yeah.
I mean, there are people out there, and I know people who retired. They had their 30 years in by the time they were 55, and you get, a percentage or equivalent to your highest 3 years. I don't know the exact formula. And they're, what people do is they stack a lot of overtime and stuff in their last years. And I know people, they're 55. They can still work another job, and they're pulling down a pension of $125,000 a year. That's not sustainable in a country where the birth rate is falling. As a result, there is a good argument can be made to bring people and workers in to support your retirees and your pensioners and the people on Social Security and Medicare and Medicaid. And this is happening all over Europe. It's why Europe has encouraged immigration. But it comes at a great cost. So there's a big argument in Bible prophecy about who is the Antichrist, where does he come from? There are a number of different views. I sort of say the classical Hal Lindsey view that he comes from Europe, a revived Roman Empire. There's the Joel Richardson view that he's an Islamic Antichrist. I sort of take the view that he's sort of a Islamist religious leftist Islamist fake Christianity guy. He kind of combines all of those qualities. But if you take the view of Joel Richardson, I think a good argument can be made that if the Lord doesn't return in 30 years, it's going to be irrelevant whether he comes from Europe or the Middle East, because they're both going to be largely Islamic by that time based on current demographics.
The thing is, though, so, I would put into that mix, though, is the fact that you've got the Sunnis and the Shia and, the Alawites and these different factions that – are they ever going to be able to coexist, or are they sooner or later they going to come to war amongst themselves?
Well, they're already at war amongst themselves.
Well, I mean, seriously, big war with nuclear weapons and so on.
Well, that's interesting, and that's why you see the tension right now between Saudi Arabia and Iran. I always want to call it Persia in Iran. I mean, they're effectively at war. Everybody's become very good at fighting their wars through proxies in all these different places. And look, the United States does it too. I mean, you know, they fund rebel groups because they think that it's going to help them. And I think, you know, the Saudis, they don't want America to withdraw from the Middle East because then they're going to have to go in there and maybe put their own people up there to fight. And they don't want to do that. And Iran doesn't really want to put their people in there in large part if they can use the Syrians and other people in the, you know, the Hezbollah faction in Lebanon to do their fighting for them. It's a very interesting thing, but you know, it all does play into Bible prophecy because we know that these are where some of the wars and battles and that type of thing are going to come from. And one of the things that seems to unite them is, you know, their distaste for the Jewish state of Israel, and that's what the Bible says will happen. So, I think it's all lining up. I'm trying to take it, you know, I don't think it'll last that long. I just think the world is incredibly volatile. I think the Saudis have made rapprochements towards Israel because they're in a weak position right now. They've had some issues with the oil price. Now oil seems to be up in price, so they're doing a little bit better, but they're not strong militarily. I mean, I have, you know, some graphics here from a few years ago. I mean, Saudi Arabia only has 26 million people. Turkey and Iran today have around 80 million people. Egypt is about 85 or 90 million people. There's wide disparities in their gross domestic product. Turkey is much more productive than Iran. Turkey is the largest army in NATO outside of the United States. Their GDP is probably per capita is probably twice what it is in Iran. Now, Iran seems to be recovering from the sanctions and that type of thing. So, and you see this alliance that's sort of, I think, softly come together between Iran and Russia and Turkey. They've had a couple of big meetings now. They had one just about 2 weeks ago. But I don't think it's a very strong alliance. I personally think that there is some kind of war based on what Daniel chapter 10 says. There's some kind of conflict coming between Turkey and Iran. Erdogan seems to be emboldened. He's called special elections to pump up his stature. He has talked very openly. I mentioned this in my update last week. He has talked very openly over the last year and a half, of how he is wants to reconstitute the Ottoman Empire. He's talked about taking over the holy places of Mecca and Medina. He's now pushing into some of the Greek islands. He's talked about parts of Greece that he thinks really belong to Turkey. So I think there's yet a conflict to come between Turkey and Iran. Russia, you know, they're not particularly strong. Their economy is based pretty much on oil and natural gas. They fear the rise of the natural gas that Israel has and the pipeline that they want to build to go into Europe to compete with Russian gas.
Well, I think that's a really big, big point in what is going on, is that, you know, the reserves in the Golan Heights, because, you know, that is kind of disputed territory, though it's in Israel. But a lot of people, the Arabs and things don't want it to be part of Israel. And, of course, there's a whole lot of reserves in there. Why Russia's there.
Yeah, in fact, when we were up there in last May, I did take a picture of a big oil drilling rig up there in the Golan Heights. And I'm trying to remember the name of the company. It was like Aftec. Well, I think it said, I'd have to look through my pictures. I think it was AFTEK, I think, but I stopped and took a picture of it. I just thought, well, you know, I've been reading about this, and actually I have a friend who used to work for the CIA, and he shared with me some documents a number of years ago. I think they're public. I can't find them, though. But what it was there were studies that were done to show the oil reserves in terms of shale oil and other oil reserves up in that area of southern Syria, northern Israel, the Golan Heights. And there are pretty extensive maps and charts that I had access to at one time. So look, and we know that there's talks, there have been talks about a pipeline coming through that area of Syria from Qatar to kind of bypass the bottleneck of the Persian Gulf. So look, there are many, many things in play that make Syria much more valuable than it is. I personally don't think that the United States has the there might be people who desire it, but I just don't think we have the military strength or ability to occupy Syria, to control that area. I just don't think we can do it. I mean, our military has been severely weakened under the Obama administration, and hopefully the president realizes that. I think we're in desperate straits. I went through the nuclear posture review that our government put out just a few months ago. And when you look at, for example, the ability to use tactical nukes, we have virtually no capability at all. And Russia has that capability in about eight areas that we don't have. So this whole thing is very, very volatile. I'm very concerned about what's going to happen between Russia and the United States. Frankly, Tony, I don't trust anybody on the world scene. I know that it's like a hair trigger. It's just something that could erupt any moment.
Yeah. You're talking about the pension thing and the financial thing and all that. Well, see, I actually think that's a huge underlying factor going on here, that the whole global financial system is in sooner or later, the whole thing's going to implode. And I think it's going to be a deliberate implosion so that they can bring about a whole new financial system, because it's not sustainable the way it is. And so, you know, is it going to be war that triggers the financial collapse and the bringing in of a new system, or is it the other way around? The financial system collapses and then the wars come out. But I think that's kind of like an underlying elephant in the room, that the way the whole global financial system is, it's unsustainable, and that there are players preparing to put new system into place. With cryptocurrencies and all that, and we are, a global cryptocurrency network, which we won't have time to get into today. But I do feel that that's a big underlying factor in what's going on here as well. So sooner or later, it can't sustain.
Well, I can only say that as someone who, I'm an attorney, and I work in commercial banking and finance. And while many banks have record earnings, the activity of the banks has changed dramatically. They don't seem to be making loans. I've done a lot of foreclosures. So when things go bad, it's usually good news for me, for my business. But the banks have pulled back in the foreclosure market way back from what they were a few years ago. I mean, 5 years ago, I was very, very busy. Now, a lot of us that do work in commercial banking are looking for work, looking for clients and cases and things to sustain us. It's something is going on, is all I can say. It's very volatile. I think that whatever run-up has been during the early part of the Trump administration has been a lot of smoke and mirrors. But the one thing I know, Tony, and I think you would agree with this, is as we look at things happen from a Bible prophecy standpoint, the one thing that we see is an acceleration, a velocity to something. So it's sort of like if you're flying along towards a target, at 1,000 miles an hour, but you're 500 miles from the target. Well, it doesn't it doesn't really bother you that much. But if you're if you're 4 feet from the target, then everything seems like it's happening very, your closing speed seems to happen more. And then the target starts moving towards you at a similar speed. Everything happens very quickly. And so I see that compression of time. So when I talk about a 20 or 30 year out demographic problem, personally, I think we're going to see even that compress, and all of those demographic problems are going to happen a couple of decades earlier than everybody thinks. And the only thing that that serves to do is to make this an even more volatile world, and even everything more of a hair trigger than it has been. Now, I don't know if I should share this. It's just that when things were heating up with the Syrian thing, which was, how long ago was that? Was it just like a week and a half ago?
It was
a week ago. It was like,
yeah, it would have been a week and a half ago. Yeah, week and a half to 2 weeks. Yeah.
Now, isn't that, there's a good point right there. It seems like it was a month ago.
Yeah.
It was just 10 days ago, because look at all the stuff that's happened in the last 10 days. And this is the way I think it is until the Lord returns now. It's just things are going to happen quickly. As I look at the prophetic scriptures, I know they'll unfold in the real world. And they may not unfold the way that we thought they would 50 years ago. That's why I encourage people, the joke among some Bible prophecy teachers is that there's a reference in Revelation to 30 minutes of silence at one point. And that 30 minutes of silence is so that all the Bible prophecy teachers can update their charts and graphs. And I think that's true. So I always say, I don't do anything that's printed. I keep mine in PowerPoint where it can be easily edited. And I do think we need to be open to that. Well, what we thought back in the 1960s with the European common market, that's not the way the world is now. The world has changed dramatically, and the world could change very dramatically in the next 2 or 3 years. It's crazy. I mean, a month ago, we were talking about going to war, nuclear war with North Korea. Now we're talking about, everybody's making nice over there. And I don't trust any of them.
Yeah.
Because they're going to act in their own best interest. Yes. And I think apart from people trying to orchestrate things, which I think people do, sometimes I don't think they're very good at it. But the overarching thing is that even if they weren't trying to orchestrate things, we seem to be hurtling down this road to this massive series of conflicts. It's troubling. I get calls from people, and, I just think, I don't know what it looks like before the Lord returns or the rapture happens or that type of thing. I don't know that date. I don't know that exit. So I have to prepare like I'm going to be here. And I think everybody needs to prepare mentally, physically, and that type of thing. I don't think you have to go crazy, but the hardest part for me is, I'm an older guy. I have a 401k, and how do you protect that? What do you do to protect yourself? And the answer is there's only so much that you can do, because there are people that have control over the system. And so it's very troubling, but I do have this strange sense of peace, because I know the Lord and I trust in Him, and I know what, if anything happens to me, I know where I'm going. And, I don't know how people that don't have that can function.
Well, that's a very good point. And I think we all need to have our eyes focused on that and on God, on Jesus, and looking for His return, and not living in fear, and watch where our own hearts are at. I know that's a big challenge for me all the time, to challenging myself. Where am I at? with my heart towards God and how much lukewarmness is there and how, you know, I know I should be far more focused than I am, but I think we all have to do that while the time is short. So maybe it would be actually a good way to close out our show would be for you to pray for those people that are listening.
Yeah, I have a friend. I'll just one quick story. I have a friend right now. He and some of his friends have gone up into Syria, the Kurdish areas of Syria, Iraq, and Iran, and they're sharing the gospel. These people, there are Christians that they're meeting with. I've seen pictures of them. He sends them to me with the faces blacked out because they are under severe persecution. It costs them everything to become a Christian, to become a follower of Jesus Christ. But he said, he has mentioned a number of times in his emails this week, he's there right now, of meeting with Muslims, sharing the gospel with them. They've been receptive. They've come to faith in Jesus. And the Christians have this, there's no question that the Christians there are more persecuted than almost anywhere else on earth. And yet there is a sense of joy among them in their community. And we've lost that in the West. We live in this, you know, everybody, I mentioned this before, everybody could, you say something and people immediately construe it in the most negative way possible. And I think persecution is coming here. I think it's coming to the West. And the only thing that will sustain us is the faith in Jesus Christ. So let me just is pray and we can conclude. Father, I just pray that people will hear this and they will maybe be prompted to look at the fact that we live in a very volatile world where things seem unstable, but that there is a permanent, fantastic, joyous hope in Jesus Christ, who we know will return and rule and reign and gather to himself the people of God. But I just pray, Father, if there are people there that don't know the Lord, that they will seek him out, that they will put their faith in Jesus Christ and him alone for their salvation and their hope and their trust and their faith. In Jesus' name, amen.
Amen. Well, yes, John, we've covered quite a bit, so much more we could have brought out. So we'll maybe have to come back in a few weeks and do some more. But thank you. This was extremely interesting, and I've learned a lot from today's show. So thank you for being on the A Minute to Midnight show again.
Sure. Thank you, Tony. It's good to be with you again.
Just like to remind folks that A Minute to Midnight is run by donations, 100% by donations, and you can find ways to donate on our website, aminutetomidnight.com, via credit card or PayPal. And we thank those people that do help us out. We certainly couldn't keep this running without your support, so many thanks to the people that do contribute to keeping this running. Also on our website you can find our shows as archives in both audio and video format, and we put them on YouTube and iTunes as well. All the music that you find in the shows is written, played and recorded by me, and you can find some free music on aminutetomidnight.com, our website too. And our team writes articles, and you'll find them on our website too. So maybe you might want to click the follow or bookmark aminutetomidnight.com. Don't forget to like our video on YouTube if indeed you did like it, and if you're looking at it that way. So thank you folks for listening to the show today. We will be back with another A Minute to Midnight show in a few days' time. Until then, God bless and have a great week. So this is Tony signing out.